Put it this way, suppose I or someone here selected themselves to be the doubter and opposed everything. Now, I think your progress would be very slow. I'm inclined to think it would be solid. Whereas, if you believe, then you will sort of keep pace. I imagine being set up in a debate, for instance, against a good opponent.
Yeah.
And many of the things you have said to me, I have accepted because you have said them. Mm. Perhaps I wouldn't win, you see. So, is it better to be a doubter or a believer?
Well, yeah, Christ said about this, blessed is he who, having seen, believes, and more blessed is he who, not having seen, believes. And it's a question about time. Energy impulses take time. If you are doubting, you are determined to analyze. Doubt means doubleness. In comfort, you will have to cut everything. Now, if the other fellow is passive to your questions, you'll cut him to bits using the Socratic method, won't you? Mm. Let's look at the Socratic method. Subject and predicate. And the rule in logic is S equals P. That is, the subject can be exhausted in all its predication. If you say the total significances of all that's involved in a subject, you have exhausted the subject. So logically we say S equals P. Now, when we actually come to talk about a given subject, we have to speak about the subject analytically and say S equals predicate 1. That doesn't exhaust it, does it?
No.
We've analysed something out of it. Plus predicate 2, plus predicate 3 to the nth, and so on. So, we have to keep on cutting the subject into a series of predicates. But each predicate contains another subject, doesn't it? Because every sentence necessarily has a subject and a predicate. Mm. So there's another S equals P1 there, isn't it? Plus P to the end. Mm? Mm. And the same for this one. And the same for this one. But every one of these predicates requires a full sentence which has a subject and predicate. So there's an S equals P there, and so does this one. Hmm? You can see immediately the meaning of an infinite digression. So doubt means doubleness. That's the same dub in dubious and double. Hmm? If we reduce this to its fundamental concept, we can lead the nature out of there. This is the hub and the wheel. There is the fairing, the rim. And it is divided. That's the house. Forces radiate from the centre and divide the wheel. Now, we can go on doing this with any subject whatever, until, in fact, we completely blocked the wheel out with definition. If we don't block it out, there's still room for another predicate. When we have blocked it out, what we've got is a terribly difficult thing, namely an analysed whole that now requires synthesizing, which means simultaneous assimilation. The argument is serial. The assimilation of significance must be simultaneous. You can't get the S back by predication P to the nth without putting S at the end. It goes like this in London. See? That's all. The subject is analysed into predicates to a degree, and those are synthesised back into the subject. And if you don't complete the synthetic process, all your predication is done is cut you to bits and turn you into a schizophrenic. In fact, that's how schizophrenia develops. By doubt, by scepticism, by cutting things to bits. Nevertheless, the product of other people's doubt is very, very useful to people who don't doubt. When Thomas put his finger in the wounds of Christ, that he put his finger in that hole convinced the others that they weren't wrong to believe. Yet they were not doubters. Some of them were afraid to doubt. Afraid even to contemplate doubt. And Descartes starts off with the very principle, philosophically, of saying, I will be quite sure that I know what I know by doubting all things. When he said this, it threw him back on something he couldn't doubt. Namely, when he said to himself, I am saying something, he couldn't doubt that. Therefore, he formulated, doesn't the finger go up at that, any? I think, therefore, I am. That was a bad bit of logic, too, because to say, I think, therefore, I am, is really to equate think and am. The two differences in the predicates must be resolved and synthesized in the I. So really it was saying that every observer necessarily has in it thinking and being. But that is already deposited in observer, if it exists. And Descartes didn't notice he'd done this, and so he became a dualist, as you'd expect from a man called Descartes. He starts from the cards, blank, and finishes up with the cards. So, doubt is very, very useful. It's a very, very good instrument for cutting into the arguments of people to test them and see whether they doubt it. And providing they don't understand this elementary logic represented by this equation, you can shake them where they're shakeable, using a purely Socratic method. When they make a statement, S, and you say it has a subject and a predicate, and you question to define the subject and each predicate, unless they have infinite knowledge, they will find they cannot tie the predication together and restate the subject. So doubt is a tool for cutting into things, for dividing. So doubt is the devil.
Go to your own ideas, and you're only going to cut yourself.
You cut yourself to bits. Now, it is a fact that if you doubt anything whatever about your own capacities, you introduce error into them. Supposing a person learning to play the piano doubts their ability to play a certain passage, the doubt is fed into the nervous system and becomes bad fingering. And the same with a man learning to sing or something like that, or to run or swim. If a man is dieting and doubts as he leaves the board that he's going to make a perfect jackknife, it won't be a perfect jackknife. Because the only way you can get the form you want is absolute unity. You want monoideism. You must have in your mind one only idea if you wish to express one idea. Because whatever you put in the mind will tend to move into the emotive centers and then into the body. So that if you doubt, that means you've presented yourself with a double content, your energy splits, and you become inefficient. So it has no use for a man that's trying to integrate himself, but it has use if you are trying to expose the disintegration of another man. Socrates himself had no doubt whatever, but he knew that other people were not immune to statements of doubt. So he used this method of analysis, of doubling up on the questions all the time, with this simple equation saying, if the man is not infinitely stopped with predication, his subject will come to an end. And if it is infinitely stopped, he's talking to God, in fact, because only God is infinite in his predication. So, as far as doubt is concerned, you can say it's very, very useful for testing situations. But it's no use at all for a man that's trying to integrate his will.
When does belief become knowledge? What do you say by that? If some doubter comes along, you believe in him, and they doubt it, and you want to express your belief clearly, and you can't do it. You can't really clearly.
You can't express it.
Yes, you can't express it clearly.
That is not a question of belief. That's a question of the power of expression, isn't it? That really means you want more work on your vocabulary and on the formal side of your knowledge. Doesn't mean anything else. Remember, a scientist does not know anything. He only believes certain things. As a matter of fact, modern science is built entirely on statistical probability. No modern scientist claims to know that anything is. He only claims that it is probable. And the laws of probability are built on a very, very simple series of experiments, times plus times to one, that this thing must happen again. Because in fact there is no certainty whatever. In a material universe, all the particles of which are in motion, and no particle is fixed from which to make an observation. Hence the growth of statistical probability theories in modern times. There is no fact other than a long series of observations collated and the similarities drawn out, and then mathematical processes applied to them to produce out of it no more than a probability. If I toss a coin into the air, is it likely that it will fall down heads or tails? Well, assuming for one moment that the weight on both sides is equal, then the possibilities of it falling heads or tails are equal. Now if I toss it up once, and then it falls down and comes up heads, and I pick up the same penny and do it again, is it more likely than it was the first time that it will come down heads or tails? It isn't. It's exactly the same. But simply because it is the same, there is no reason to assume that it will fall down heads again.
Could I ask something there? If you concentrated on getting heads up...
That's an entirely different thing. You're now talking about magical interference.
Yes.
And science isn't interested in them. In fact, if it were to exist, science would immediately start to become impossible. It's a magician sitting about willing electrons suddenly to become positrons, something, and the nuclei of atoms suddenly to disperse and go to the perimeters. Well, you'd be wasting your time in the microscope and various other measuring devices. The whole order of the universe is the basis of science. Unless there is a rigid order of some kind, science is impossible. No rigid order is known other than this mathematical statistical one by the scientists. So when we come to the question of doubt, you can see that simply to doubt is to introduce division, because doubt means present yourself with two ideas simultaneously about the same subject. So it necessarily splits the nervous energy in you and transmits it in two different directions, so that if you try to do a thing with doubt in your mind, say take that chalk and throw it between the bars of some railings or something, if you doubt it, you will feel something wrong the moment you release it in doubt, and something will go wrong with the throw. The whole meaning of the Zen Buddhism is the elimination of doubt. You're not allowed to think about it, because thinking is doubting. Remember the diagram we've done before? Of the thinking process, as the word think. If we change the K to a hard G, we've got to think. Now, thinking is thinking in the mind. So if we now do a figure of eight, and we put K up there, and hard G down there, and shade this one in, because the hard G is the Ge of the Greeks, the earth, the material, and K, being an unvoiced consonant, means it is on the intellectual side. This is the realm of ideas. This is the realm of gross material facts. So if we look with our sense organs into the gross material world, we see Ge, earth, thing. But if we look into the mind, at the form without the gross matter, we call it think. So, T, this is a Masonic sign for you, TH in Ge. This TH I'll draw now a little more like an X sign up there. This is the origin of the TH. This is the Templum Hierosimum, the Temple of Jerusalem of the Masons. Here we have the origin of the three T's, which are simply made from the perimeter of a circle and three radii. Now, TH means time and eternity. Remember we've said about the Greek alphabet that the old form of writing the fifth letter of the alphabet is that, and in English is that. These two letters are interchangeable. In the Hebrew, the fifth letter is a he, like that, and would be used to represent this vowel, just like this sign would be in the Greek. So this means time, and that means eternity. And the whole process is involved here. And when that process is made darkened by intensification and overlapping of energies, that is the making gross of the subtle. Let's look at the Indian analysis now. The soul, the mind, and the body. We put an S in there for subtle, G in there for gross, and C in there with a little stroke on to remind us it's K for causal. The soul here is causal. All mental structures, whatever, are subtle, and your body is gross. That's very, very important to realize this. When we're talking in Western philosophy about causation, we're talking about a linear series where one thing strikes another and the shock is passed along in a chain. That's linear causation. That is an occidental concept which springs out of an extrovert mind. Occidentally, to strike the table is to introduce a cause. But the Oriental concept of causation is totally different. The Oriental says the cause is in the field. That an atom does not move because another atom hits it, but because the field of the atom changes. Now, as a matter of fact, modern science has been forced into exactly that same conclusion. Because if we take an electron, we know that it has a field around it. And in fact, two of those electrons cannot come together because of the field forces between them. They repel each other. So the cause of the repulsion is in the field, not in the electron. So you see, the real theory of causation is not a linear series in the material world, which is entirely a materialistic concept, hitting its high peak in the 19th century. But the causal is essentially non-dual. We're going to draw a line over there now. The soul has no parts. It is not a compound. A material body is a compound, and a subtle body, namely an idea complex, is also a compound. So this is the realm of the compounded here, the body and the mind, and this is non-compound. I'll put non-K in there. Nonk. It's a nice word, isn't it? So, we know that the soul is eternal simply because it has no parts. What has no parts cannot come to bits. What cannot come to bits is not mortal, because mortal means disintegrating. But the physical body can and does fall to bits very easily, and the body of ideas falls to bits not so easily. If a motor bus hits your body, it can break it very, very easily. But it doesn't break your ideas so very, very easily. Very deep ideas are not even removed by a brain injury. Although that your latest impressions may be very easily removed by a blow causing concussion. And the deeper beliefs you have are very hard to eradicate. So the more subtle a compound is, the more power it has, the greater resistance to disintegration. The soul, not being a compound, is eternal, and not being a compound is infinite. Being infinite, it is omnipresent. Therefore, the soul is an infinite, eternal, omnipresent. The mind is the product of a relation between bodies and the soul. So we'll draw another line here. The mind is now mediating between the soul, which is eternal, non-compounded, and the gross body. This represents the devil, this represents God. Not in his father, but in the son, the logos sense. The mind function here is to carry stimuli from the body and bring them up to the soul, who will then give orders about them back to the material world. So in the mind there's a continuous circulation of stimulus reaction the afferent and efferent flow of the nervous impulses going on all the time. We have these three interpenetrating spheres, which I've separated out here. If we wish to, here is the mind, and here is the gross body, GB or Great Britain. Where there are more bodies than one, there is external stimulation. Physical reaction of the external sense organ, like the eye, the retina, to the light. Then the carrying inwards into the mind, along the nerves in the brain, to nerve centres. The presentation of the resultant to the soul, and the giving of the orders by the soul back through the mind to the body. We remember that when a rotation occurs, it can never go to the dead centre. It has to come out again, never having filled in the centre, so it makes always an action band, continuous in going and outgoing. And that empty part in the middle is the soul, where it is pure spirit. The thick skin on the orange here represents the gross material world. The pulp of the orange represents the mind. And the hidden space in the seed represents the soul itself. And yet that soul energy goes right out, as we said before, the spirit immanent in the soul, spirit transcendent, and it's continuously flowing out and back, and that is the field of the whole structure. So your gross physical body and your mental body, your subtle body of ideas, are all inside a field, and it is that field which is causative. Now let's have a look at the theory of evolution in relation to this. We said that the Western idea of evolution is the idea that you can keep pulling things out of a bag that were never put into it. The idea that somehow there are qualities emerging that were not there. That matter, which is non-intelligent, somehow by conjoining together accidentally, produces intelligence. So as intelligence is then stated to be something that wasn't in the original situation. Now, in fact, we find another subject and predicate. See? Every seed produces a plant, every plant produces a seed, and so on, in an infinite cycle. If the plant were not involved in the seed could never become a plant. If the plant did not involve itself in seeds, and then scatter them, it could never propagate its kind. So there's an endless cycle from seed, plant, seed, plant, seed. This also is semen, if you like, and this is a person. Exactly the same thing, for every life comes out of an egg or a seed. It isn't a piece of wood or stone that gives birth to a baby, it's the seed of a man. So the man evolves into the seed, and the seed evolves into the man. So every E or X volution, vol means will, every outwilling presupposes an involution. Now let's draw this again. Here is the world of the soul, here is the world of gross matter. This is one of the esoteric meanings of the number 8. This soul enters into the gross world, circulates through it, and goes out again. Now here is involution. And at the bottom point here is where the materialist scientist starts to examine it. And he says there is gross matter with no intelligence. Really, the intelligence of the soul here has obscured itself with its own activity. I can obscure the form of my hand by shaking it. How many fingers have I now, you see? If I shake it very fast, you can't tell what I've got. That is exactly the same kind of obscuration that there is of the soul. The soul is in no sense touched by action. The form of my hand doesn't change by shaking it. Nevertheless, it is obscured to the vision. So this is action, settle up there, getting steadily grosser and grosser in layers. That's quite fine. That's the intellect point there in matter, and the soul above it. That's the buddhi of the Hindus. And here's the manas, the indriyas, the sense organs and the gross body. When we come down exactly to the gross material part of the scientist, then, because he is an extrovert, an empiricist, he starts here and says, insentient matter evolves and produces intelligence. He's giving you half of a process. And he's been quite illogical, because he arbitrarily starts with the gross material world. He knows for a fact that gross matter is force, rotating. But because of a certain bias to do with profound negativism and the world to dominate the external situation, he prefers to start down there and say, there was no intelligence. This is the voice of Julian Huxley. Blind nature, working for countless millions of years, produced Julian Huxley. That was a radio statement. And he then said, altering the diagram a little bit, if blind nature can produce Julian Huxley, think what Julian Huxley can do. You see? That's because he started there. And we know for a fact that there is no motion whatever in the whole universe that is not cyclic. Rectilinear motion is an abstract idea. It does not exist. And therefore, to start there is entirely arbitrary. We have to start with intelligence, even the scientist has, otherwise he's not a scientist. Then he has to put his intelligence into the material situation, down to the lowest point, namely the gross material, and then he must proceed to explain to himself how it became organized. But organization means intelligence. There is no organ, no working entity, other than an intelligent one. If I put dots about here, how can you move it? Because my natural sense of rhythm might start putting order in them, I'm not careful. If I put them down haphazardly, then I could say that is chaos. And by deliberately ignoring the fact that I did it to demonstrate chaos, I must cut out my own intelligence and then stare at it and pretend I don't exist. Then I can say that's chaos, that's senseless, there's no meaning in it. To say that, I must eliminate myself. So the scientist, when he eliminates himself from the universe, postulates an abstract state of the universe, gross material, without himself in it, and then proceeds to try to build up a theory that accounts for the appearance of his own brilliance. First, having rubbed it out, that was S, my shining self, then the dirty globe, put a G on the bottom to make sure it's a gross one, and finally S again. We now rub off the first S and say, don't let's mention that, start with this and get this. I have now improved. Now the whole object of Western culture is to improve. And you must have a concept like this to improve. Start from there and keep going like that. The idea that it's a cycle implies possible degeneration. And you know, we can't degenerate. We can only go on improving and improving and improving. The fact that some old men that have been quite brilliant become idiots. It's just them, you see, they're special cases. The fact that innocent babies become very, very cunning old men, and so on. All the factual cycles of the universe have to be ignored in order to postulate that there is an insentient, non-intelligent gross matter which climbs up and becomes a shining self, explaining to itself how it managed to emerge from unintelligence. So, every evolution presupposes an involution, and the involution is going on all the time. Supposing we take the great period of the Saurians, the great lizards. A force of life was lizarding into matter. And after it had gone round, it came out and said, well, I'm born with lizarding, and it stopped. There's always a little period of quiescence in between phases. In the record of the rocks, there are little blank layers. There's a period when life does nothing except rest and rumble and think to itself, funny things those lizards I made. What shall I make next? Now in between thinking, funny thing those lizards, and what shall I make next, He doesn't make anything. He's just quiescent. That is the pralaya state of the Indian philosophers. He's just lying down and musing on its legendary exercise and deciding it's not going to do it again because, well, it exhausted its enjoyment. Next time it's going to enter, it's going to make something else, something really clever. And each time it has built an organism, it has sought to make an organism that it would not have to give up. In other words, it's trying to make a perfect vehicle that it will never have to give up. And the best job it's done so far is a human being. And if a human being should turn out to be a lounge lizard, it will have to be eliminated. And of 20,000 million human beings on Earth today, most of them are considered by this self unsavable. That is to say, they're going to be eliminated in a series of catastrophic wars. We're running towards one now. And there's no attempt on the part of the vehicles to stop this process, except in little odd spots here and there. If people can understand that the cause of all conflict down here is the search of the life force for a perfect vehicle, and that until it gets a perfect vehicle, it is going to destroy vehicles. When the vehicle eventually is made perfect, there will be no necessity to destroy it because it will be absolutely responsive to the will of the soul. That is the statement of the New Testament, then we shall be made perfect. And another word used for it is whole, which means we have resynthesized the analyzed process of evolution and regained the S with which we started. So the soul posits forms and then gathers them together and states the soul. This process goes on and on in the attempt to make perfect vehicles, and when a perfect vehicle is made, it will be retained. And until it is made, it will not be retained, it will be considered expendable. Now let's go to Finnegan's Wake a moment. Ken wanted me to deal with this, but it's a little long, really, for an hour's talk. But Joyce was trying to do something inside himself with it. And what he was trying to do can be done. But when it is done, a man is then resynthesized into his original wholeness. You know that poetry differs from prose, not by the fact that, which isn't a fact very often, that there's a rhyme in it, whether at the end or internally, but because poetry is tremendously condensed. In order to fit in a thought into a line of a particular length, a poet has to take his ideas and hammer them together and force particular words to do many, many duties. So that, let's take the word Finnegan to begin with. It's a nice word, isn't it? Now, you know that that's the word for end, and that's the word for negation, and that's the word for a goose. When we get gander. So this says, end no goose. Now, Joyce knew this, and he was trying to integrate by becoming awake. Generative on there because he's trying to generate something. He knows that the end is no goose. Now we change end to aim because the end and the aim are the same. We hope that the end, that is where the arrow falls, will be on the spot that we aimed at. And this goose, or gan, which is euphemistic with a vowel change in term, symbolizes a migrating bird, doesn't it? Migrated bird. Now, the Indian, the Sanskrit word, the hamsa, means either a goose or a swan. You find it in Celtic mythology as part of the Trinity of the early Christian church, where there's a fool, a salmon, and a goose. The goose was chosen as the symbol of the soul because it migrates and it's white. The pure soul is represented by the goose. Now, there is no stupidity in the final aim, because the goose is very fond of walking behind other geese in this manner. A pair of geese, two geese. You know that geese are supposed to be stupid, according to the way human beings look at them. They hiss like serpents, and they walk behind each other in a line. They have formation when they migrate. Their whiteness symbolizes their purity. That they follow each other means the same thing as one soul following another into bodies. One of the old Indian illustrations of reincarnation is a wheel, which they had at fairgrounds with little boxes on. You've seen them at Blackpool and elsewhere. Now, the image they use is that a box goes down there, and the soul jumps in the box, and the wheel turns, invented by a man called Ferris, because of the ferry process here, and the pilot function. This soul is carried out, and when that little box comes down here, another soul gets in. All the boxes are full, and it rotates, and as each one goes round, when it comes to the bottom, it gets out. So we have an image of a soul incarnating in a body, and anybody looking at the wheel can predict the exact life course of one of the carriages going round. But he cannot say what the soul is doing up in the box that is at the top, which is why most people go in. The soul is free to do what it likes inside the box. The materialist scientist and the predictor of body behavior is concerned with the material body going round and round and round. He cannot predict the soul's subjective attitude to the whole thing, neither does he know where the soul goes when it steps out of the box. The conservation of energy in the material universe guarantees a continuous supply of boxes, and the souls incarnating in them get the experience out of them. Now, there is no end to the cycle of the wheel, but there's a period of quiescence when the whole universe winds into potentiality and dreams about what it's been doing before it starts up and does it again. So, let us say that every soul is a goose, and that there's no end to the cyclic process. And if you wake up and realize just precisely what it is that makes you get on the wheel and go round, you all know what you do when you go out there in couples, don't you? There's something that makes you want to get into the box, go to the top of the wheel, where nobody can see you, and then you come down again smiling broadly, thinking it's a secret. And all around you and others coming up to have the same secret. And it's precisely this that pays the money in to keep the wheel turning. Buddha said it was thirst, tamma, thirst for life, that kept the wheel turning. There's a man there, and he'll keep putting petrol in and turning it, or pressing an electric switch, to keep it going if you keep putting money in his pocket to buy his din-din so that he has the strength to pour the petrol in. So it's an endless merry-go-round with the souls getting on, and they keep going round and round and round and round until they realize it isn't a secret. They had a profoundly egotistical purpose, and they said, let's get in this box and go up there and do a secret thing. In the same way, now another image, this one, the wheel is down below and the souls are above. They say, let's go down there where nobody can see. Because in the realm of the soul, there is no plurality whatever. So, whatever is known absolutely, so you can't have a secret. And at the point of contact between the intellect here and the soul, as the intellect is a determinative faculty, it tells you that there are secret possibilities down there. So the soul thinks, I'll have a secret. Why should I be known always and forever? So it dives into the dark to perform secret activities, and it goes on doing it until it finally discovers that everybody else is doing precisely the same secret activities, and then egotistically says, well, if they're going to do it, I'm not. And it gives it up, and it comes out of the wheel and won't pay any more money. It says it's beyond that now, it goes away. It's now called an evolved soul. It's turned itself out of the wheel. It's gone in and it's come out. Now, in this Finnegan's Wake idea, it's just a fundamental concept of this entrance of the soul into manifestation, its self-obscuration by its own activity. Nothing obscures you except your own process, just like nothing obscures my hand except my waving it. You stimulate your own mind and it produces ideas and completely obscures your own nature, and then you wonder who you are, because you're looking at a product of your own activity. And as long as you look at the product, you're looking at P to the nth, not at S. You're only looking at predication, and you can never find out what the soul is, what the subject is, by examining the predicates. Because at the end of the equation, you must write equals S again. You must remember the subject with which you started. That needs a good memory. So that when people enter into manifestation, their obscuration gives them a bad memory. They forget who they are, and the presentations of their own activities in their own minds fascinates them. This is the myth of Narcissus, looking into the waters of his own mind and saying, what a lovely lad I am, and refusing to listen to anything whatever outside. So it goes on and progressively obscures itself. And we've said before that if the will were always to get a pleasure out of experience, it would go down and do it again forever. So if the whole of this wheel were pleasurable, nobody could ever get out. Luckily for us, the wheel is sometimes painful, and we put a negative there, and it climbs up into the head and becomes shining intelligence. Only out of the negation can thought grow. So only out of the experience of pains can this soul, which has obscured itself, become aware of the foolishness of its self-obscuration. Finnegan's Wake is about this process. And no goose. The goose is supposed to be a fool. But in fact, before entrance into this process, the soul is an analyzed whole. A whole that doesn't know its parts, because it has not actually parted. It is a non-synthetic whole. Then it precipitates a duality. I like it and I don't like it. And then it tries to embody for itself, in gross matter, the things it likes. And it tries to stop the things it doesn't like from getting into manifestation. But plus and minus, yes and no, presuppose each other. They stand or fall together. So when it postulates pleasure, it postulates fear of the deprivation of pleasure with it. Here is the soul partless. It doesn't even know that it's a soul partless until it posits pleasant pain. This is the Adamic fall. It involves itself in the gross material world, subjects itself to experience, and after lots of dodging, finally comes to believe that it can only regain its initial freedom by the negative or painful process. But what it gains when it gets back is its original wholeness plus the memory of the plus minus and the gross material fact. And when it has evolved into itself in reflexive self-consciousness, the imagery of the whole cycle, then, in New Testament parlance, he shall go no more out. And in Buddhist parlance, he will again near nirvana and he will manifest no more. The whole process is simply to become reflexively aware that once the soul passes, not even knowing it was a soul, initiated pleasures and initiated pains necessarily with them, went down to get the pleasures and avoid the pains, found dialectically that they could not be got and that the pains drove it up, to realize that it had itself involved itself. And that when the process of self-involvement is realized completely, the work of the soul is finished. The whole of the work referred to by the mystics of all times is simply the realization of the fact that we obscured ourselves with the pleasure pursuit, tried to throw out the pain side of it, which is illogical, were forced through material experience into the painful side, and then regained. So here we are. You see there the mystical sign of the Hermes. Here is the letter H in the Egyptian hieroglyph. We turn it this way up because we want the tails to go into infinity. And we will say, going down on the pleasure pursuit into the gross material world and finding it painful, to climb back into the process is then finished. Now there is no more work to be done in any philosophical or religious system in the world other than the recognition of this fact. The semicircle there represents infinity and the inherent dualism in the absolute, namely the potential of the form, the potential of manifestation, the potential of differentiation. So one whore is a potential plus, and the other is a potential minus. The potential minus became matter. The potential plus became intelligence. There we are, the intelligence going down, creating the material world, finding it painful, climbing up to self-realization, and at the top end, the negative now means self-control, to negate oneself. Therefore, at the highest level, the Hebrew name for the absolute is the Ein Sof, the negation wisdom. Usually they translate it the illimitable wisdom, because they don't know what to do with this word. Really it means negation. The Ein, the Hebrew letter goes like that, means I won't. I know what not to do. And therefore, as Gautama said, when you reach that stage, you are in Nirvana. You see, now this word, Vama, is the same as vain. It means going serpent. This Nir is a negation. No go. It's the state beyond Ravana, beyond raving desires. Ravana is a raving, desireful serpent. Nir is a negation. Nir is the negation of the differentiations. So Gautama is talking about the entrance into manifestation through thirst for the plus, the pleasure, the climbing up to the recognition of the law that all is suffering, and the realization of the supreme negation, nirvana. So the first word of the absolute is no, to put it down. And we'll draw it in the form of a yantra. We can put the N inside it. We let that N represent a ripple. If we put the N this way, it represents the letter Z. It means real, existing activity. Shakespeare called it, thou whoreson letter Z, thou unnecessary letter. Meaning to say that the zealous approach to things isn't necessary. There is a gentle way of getting your own way. It just takes longer. N means continuity of motion. says on the eternal serpent with tail and mouth, and you can then see the whole process is represented in this on or no drama that the Japanese call it. We have simply to do this. The infinite has already the potential of pleasure pain. Because the potential is there, it tends to actualize itself. That produces the soul. At the low point of the soul, its vibrations are not quite so fast as our here. It begins to formulate. Now all these formulations are in the subtle body, and they begin to condense and make the growth body. So inside our own bodies we have infinity, the tabula rasa of the scholastics, the plain sheet of the soul, ideation, mentation, changing process of thought, and then the gross becoming dense of the thought processes, and the cause is in the soul. Now spirit is said to be causeless because it is beyond the circle. It is beyond causation. And the spirit in the soul, which constantly flowing in and out to maintain the conjunction, is beyond causation. Because the soul is not yet parted, therefore it is not subject to dissolution. And the only things that are subject to dissolution are compounds of action. That which is compounded can disintegrate, and there is no matter in the universe that is not simply action. Matter is action. And the compounds of action can disintegrate most quickly from the gross end, not quite so quickly from the subtle body, not at all in the soul because it isn't compounded. Now, St. Paul says first a physical body, and then a spiritual body. He calls the spiritual body the body of ideas, because to him, the word spirit, the ruach, in the Hebrew, means intellect. Whereas we use the word spirit for this absolute, considering that all the form that is actualized in the intellect is eternally in the absolute. Nothing new under the sun. Nothing new can emerge. The absolute contains all possible motion compounds in continuous simultaneous interplay. They are serialized at the level of the intellect as thought processes. So, first the physical body, then the spiritual body. What did he mean by that? He meant to say we are born as gross material bodies, and inside is a soul, innocent. It would be innocent if it hadn't been born before. As it is, it's forgotten most of what it knew except how to drink milk and things like that. And when one gross body strikes another, there's a reverberation to it, and that reverberation is the gross material, which when the motions, the gross motions, die down and become finer, are called thought. That's finger, and that's thinker. Now you know, it's a psychological fact, that there's no difference whatever between the initial quality of the stimulus and the quality of that same thing viewed in the mirror. If I look at the globe up there, the light, and close my eyes, I see light. And the light that I see is simply the aftermotion of the light that I have seen. So whatever its quality was, it still is in the memory, only less intense and finer. So this is the world of fine forms, and this is the world of gross forms. And the Bible says there are two deaths. The death of the physical body, the death of the subtle body, or the four calls of the spiritual body. And it says that the person who integrates himself perfectly shall not suffer the second death. Now, the soul can incarnate in a gross body and behave itself and become a tenant, behave that one harmony. And it can climb up again, and it can integrate into the mind and go up. This happens more often than it is. The soul frequently goes into the mind and investigates ideas and never applies them to the earth. The Corbett's have a certain intellectual who knows all sorts of wonderful things and never does it. This soul is just energized infinite, and nothing happens to the earth in the world. Also, the soul, just remember our installation down there, the soul going back through the whole process. The soul can rip out beyond the intellect and process capital and the earth material body to the man of the universe. And make a wonderful body and put the soul accent in the body without disturbing it into it. Now the gross physical body dies first and most easily. That's not an absolute rule, it's only usually that it dies first. It's possible to die in the mind before your body's dead. Usually the body dies first and it tends to do so. So when the body disintegrates, death means disintegration and nothing else, then all the soul has left for a vehicle is the body of ideas, the spiritual body. Now if the body of ideas is badly integrated, it also begins to fall to bits. This is what Gurdjieff was talking about when he talked about souls scrambling for bodies, like the theosophical astral bodies and so on. The idea that there is a subtle body there, a body of ideas, and that when one soul has learned the lesson of that idea body, he will give it up. He will just say, I'm not interested. Like he's given up his gross physical body when it becomes too painful. When the gross external world ceases to pay off, many a soul, without a disease in the body, withdraws from the body and dies. And many another person with a very badly damaged body and the will to keep in it will keep it going because he wills to use it. Gurdjieff actually kept his body going after a very bad crash because he willed to use it. When it became not worth it, then he withdrew. So the subtle body, the body of ideas here, just like the gross physical body is discarded and the physical body begins to disintegrate fairly rapidly, so this body of ideas, when the soul has lost interest, is released in the subtle world. And then other souls who've not finished, and their own bodies were disintegrated, seeing this nice body, and by resonance, feeling a sympathy towards it, they gather around it, and they try to get into it, just like sperm is trying to get into an ovum. And the one with the strongest similarity to that body gets into it. And the others are all very annoyed because they wanted it. So the evolution that goes on in the gross physical body, the thing body, is paralleled in the think body. And just in the same way that people scramble for the distribution of the gross material body, like crows and things, so there are discarnate souls here, or souls with inferior integration, who would love to own that body, and the moment it's discarded by a soul who's now seen the fruitlessness of further experience, not the fruitlessness of experience, the fruitlessness of further experience, the body is then released, and other souls try to get into it. When you look at a lot of sperm banging at an ovum, without any consideration for each other, each one determined to get in, and yet the ovum has the capacity, a peculiar capacity, of keeping them all out. No individual sperm has the power to penetrate the wall of the ovum. But the ovum has a wonderful sensitivity which tells it who is knocking loudest. And where the loudest knock comes, it opens up and it goes in. In the same way, the souls who have enough resonance in them to produce a response inside here, and who attack this subtle body with all they've got, that subtle body by resonance opens up to the most resonant knocker, and that soul has then got this body. This ties up with what we said about can various souls work in one body. It is known for twins to be born, identical twins, where two sperms may be so equal in their intensity they may penetrate one egg. And in the same way, two souls may be so similar in resonance, probably through working together and relating together, that they manage to penetrate the same subtle body at the same time, and they then find themselves in that lovely harmony that boys and girls like to think they will enjoy at some future. The perfect harmony of two bodies or two souls in one body. When that body is brought to the state of perfect integration, the soul has then in it the memory of the whole process. And it has involved the memory of the gross in the subtle, the thing in the think, and the think into the original TH. Looks like a frowning man, right? Because he had such opinions. So you see, the whole process is a very, very simple one, represented on this inverted Egyptian hieroglyph of the H.
Could you say something about the causal from that, which saying is not causal?
Well, to understand what is causal and what is, remember that this Latin causus simply means to strike, to apply a force. So the concept of causation is necessarily a dual concept. It requires two. A force applied and something to apply it to. Consequently, there can be no application of the term cause in the non-finite. The infinite is the non-finite. Finite means limited, infinite means not limited. Causation requires a finite object to be struck by a finite force. Therefore, causation is an inferior concept to the infinite. So you should never think in terms of causation when you are trying to solve problems of the absolute. The absolute is entirely beyond causal relation. If you try to apply causal concepts to the absolute, you will start an infinite regression, wanting to know what caused that one to cause that one to cause that one. Just realize that the word infinite means not finite, that causation applies, by the meaning of the word, meaning strike, only to finites, a finite object receiving a finite force, and therefore the infinite is beyond the concept of causality. And where the soul itself becomes conscious of its infinity, the soul also goes beyond the causal relation and becomes itself top cause. Before it is aware of it, the stimulus from the body reverberates through the gross body, through the mind, and causes identification by catching the attention of the soul, which has unconsciously released a reverberation in the first place through the mind into the body. Now you know that this must go on, because no stimulus from the material world can cause you to react if you will not attend. You're all sitting on chairs. Before I mention it, you're not aware that you have posteriors. When you put your mind on it, you immediately become aware of sensations that were not in your mind. You have turned with your soul towards it because a directive has been given. If you will to ignore it and stare fixedly at a corner of the room, it will disappear again. In other words, the power of the soul is the cause of the initial identification. First with the idea, then with the gross material correspondent activity. But once the identification with the physical body is fixed, then every physical body there is round about, touching it causes the soul to believe that it is suffering. Suffering means to be in passive relation to the stimulus. The object is to stop suffering and become actualing. Suffer and activity. The active and the passive are opposite. Where you are suffering, it means the stimulus is hitting you and you can't do anything about it. When you do something about it, it is no longer suffering. You have turned the passive into the active. you then start climbing back, and then you discover this non-linear, this non-Western causality concept. The Western one said that gross material bodies hit on each other and start chain reactions. The Western analysis of mental processes says that mental processes are simply the product of molecular changes in the brain. Many, many things they cannot account for, because how can the molecular changes in the brain of parents involve themselves in the genes on the chromosomes of an egg, when in fact analysis reveals no parts there able to respond in those complicated instinctive manner? The complex instinctive behaviour pattern inborn in animals, like a chicken running away from the shadow of a bird that might drop on him, is a sign that intelligence has involved itself already in the gross material body. Occidental science says that the instinct is transmitted, linear causation, from body to body, and that mental processes are simply molecular vibrations in the brain. But that doesn't add up to intelligence at all. No amount of vibration of a non-sentient matter can add up to intelligence. All these vibrations are inside the soul, and at the top level of the material of the fine body, where the intellect is, there is a fine process that the soul, in identification with, can use to issue an order. There's a continuous upflow and downflow, and the linear causation of the West occurs in the subtle body when one idea chases another by association. We call it a train of association, or a chain of association, because if we say cat, dog, it tends to come into your mouth. And whatever word you hear tends to set up a linear reaction. And that's the Western causation. But the Oriental one says that all these things are mechanical and don't need to happen. The soul can insert a command, stop, to the linear causation of the gross material body. The hand is going through space and say, stop, and it stops. For some people, when you say stop, it goes on, because they're not gathered together. There are all sorts of little exercises you can do to test your own power to interfere with your soul in a physical act or in a mental act. In a physical act, you may have an itch. When it comes, you can find one in your body by sitting down and trying to be very, very quiet. Then you will find an itch. And when you feel it, don't scratch it, and notice how intense it becomes, and see whether you have the soul power to resist the scratch, and see how intense the itch becomes. If you have the power to defeat an itch, itch eye sounds like for will, you see. It's a little pinch in you. Do something about it. If you can control a little external itch, you might control an internal itch, form an idea. If you can control all the ideas and order them, integrate them into an intellectual concept, the cosmic logos, then the soul again becomes aware of its essential infinite origin. The whole process then takes on the form of a causal relation, not linear on the earth plane, but the enveloping and the field energies into the mind and into the gross body. Always the field going into the mind or into the gross body, producing changes from the field. To become aware that your feeling is the means whereby you discover you are a soul is very important. Feeling is field consciousness. If you relax on a bed in the dark, when you're perfectly relaxed, you will not know what shape your body is. It's beginning to become infinite. That is, not finite. That is, not limited, uncircumscribed. If you contract a muscle, you suddenly become aware of the shape of it. If you relax it, you lose that. and you become field conscious. If in a dark room you lie down and try to feel the room instead of your own body, you'll begin to feel little precipitations where articles of furniture. If you feel to the edges of the wall, you'll feel those. If you're doubtful, you'll think you're merely thinking about it. If instead of thinking about it, you feel it, you will feel it. If you then feel beyond the edges of your room, and there's somebody in the next room, you'll begin to feel the movements and the moods of those people. And when you become aware of the moods and feelings of other beings inside your field, you will just count them as other bodies in your field. In other words, your bodies elsewhere. And if you go on doing that exercise, spreading it out, you will discover that the whole universe shrinks into a point. The universe looks very, very big to the scientist examining gross matter. It looks very, very small to the man that becomes field conscious and deliberately extends it to include the earth, the solar system, the sidereal system itself. If that causes doubt to enter, start with something that you can believe in, like feeling somebody in the next chair with your eyes closed, feeling the breathing of somebody in the other side of the room, feeling somebody in the next room, and so on. As your feeling awareness becomes more and more and more conscious, there gradually comes the power, because our field is infinite, of precipitating there's another body. Instead of activating this body, this soul can begin to activate this body. This raises an ethical question, should you? If you start trying to manipulate this body and ignore this body, you may become engrossed in this body and somebody will take that one away and bury it. So you have to be very, very careful. I actually know a man who did this and nearly got buried because he was away for a fortnight doing a little exercise. And his wife nearly buried him. I think there was some money involved. Anyhow, luckily he'd warned a few friends to take care of him. But it is really astonishing in very, very early stages when you're not afraid. It's essential not to be afraid, because fear precipitates you back into the material world, but it's the secure world. Remember, the gross world has a purpose. It gives you security at first. And it allows you to build up a system of ideas. Then you can transfer, when your idea system is big enough, the accent of the soul from the gross world, that's physical body, to the subtle world, the spiritual body, as Paul says. Then you think your security is in ideas. But when you've integrated that, you'll think your security is in that diagram. And when you've absorbed that diagram, you'll think it's in that diagram rubbed out, which it is, which is then the original state of the soul. You are then ready to confess your infinity without trembling, because you now have a reference, a memory of the gross and the subtle in the causal. This is the direction of evolution. The infinite has absorbed itself by self-obscurations in souls, subtle bodies, gross bodies, and those bodies that it manages to refine by experience and produce integrated subtle bodies, so that they become reflexive souls. It wishes to befriend them, keep them, and support them. His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches me. So when we examine the concept of the involution of the infinite into the gross material finite, then we can see how the physical scientist considers that evolution from the finite is possible to infinite possibilities. The evolution from gross material, non-intelligent matter, in the 19th century, through ever-widening possibilities of progress, is optimism. That is to say, it's a search for the optimum. But it is only true if you state the previous involution, which then shows you the way out. Now, have we got any particular questions that could be clarified?
If you can't formulate your experiences clearly, then they're not really gained the best from them, is it?
Yes, sir. you must be able ultimately to turn your experience into words. Remember, word means order.
Let's do some more from the words.
We've done this before, and we'll do it again, because the repetition will end granite. Look at the gold in the middle of it. That's ore. When Joyce was writing this book, he looked at that and said, that's gold. And he looked at that and he said, that is two V's, two volitions. And two forces intersecting produce an entity. So W means an entity. So there's an entity of gold dividing. Gold means the supreme value. Let's draw gold as a yantra. Or, this is R, believe it or not. That's R. Just vibrating all the time. R. So, a word, that's why Scotsman is saying to you, is a zone of differentiating activity. An entity, zone, differentiating activities, dividing one thing from another. That's a word. Now, we're often asked this question, oh, that only works for English. How about another language? How about the Vought? Or the dialect, where the D is a T. Well, that's too easy. Let's take something totally different. Let's take the word from the Latins and the Logos of the Greeks. Anybody who says the German Vought is obviously the word word. So we'll take two others and see why these other peoples use other words. Now, every word is used inside the psychological context of the mind of the user. The Greeks were essentially rational. The Romans were essentially men of power. So when they're talking about the means whereby something shall be ordered, the Romans prefer a power word, and the Greeks prefer a rational word. And we'll turn this one, look. There really is an old root of power. It becomes vir in virility. It's the vir man, power, genital power. Vir, this is a Latin termination for a substance. This me is the container, the me. Power, house, substance. This is why Jakob Bulmer says, Latin is the language of the power man. They're only concerned with dominion, so they want power. The Greeks want reason. The issue, the total issue of the log. There's our log. It's just as simple as this. Nice little log. That log rolls. And out of the fact that it rolled came the wheel. Out of the wheel came the lever. So out of this log, the issue of all the log, came the wheel, the lever, the whole of the principles of mechanics, the whole of the principle of logic, which is tautological logic, that is cyclic, every S equals P equals S, which is logic. So the Greeks called it that log stuff that goes round and round and round, by means of which we lever propositions. Lever means to expend little force and get big results. To lift with little energy expenditure. With that radius we have a lever. With that rim we have a wheel. All mechanical inventions, all modern Western science springs out of Greek logic in its theoretical side. And it will still spring more out of it. Modern science borrows more and more and more from the Greek, because the Greek rational analytical mind had a word for it, for every concept. Whereas the Latin words are rooted in power, the Greek ones are rooted in form, in the logical form. So you see here, it doesn't really matter what language we take at all. Let's take the French word. Here are two French words for word. Now notice the difference. This is mot, and it's the reverse of the good English term. It actually means a word that's not rationally considered. Just a word. But this paro, which you see by the par
here, is pi rational, like the Parisians from Paris, from Troy, the Torah, brought with them. This paro is a rational word. So in the Gospel of John, when it says in English, in the beginning was the word, in the French it does not say in the beginning was the mot, because that would not be rational. So it says was this paro. This is the paro, the great rational function. The Greek says the logos. The French says paro. We say word. It means orderly principle. But this principle doesn't mean that at all. It means the irrational upspringing, like myth. See, here's the same word in the Greek, isn't it? Take the O out and change it to that Y form, which in any case is going to be myth. And you see that this word is time, backwards, or the plant time, and Tom, who's our old friend the Delta. He's a doubter because he's always splitting his sperms, because he's never sure which side he's bending buttoned on. There's a peculiar impulse in man that tends to make him propagate when he feels insecure. Instead of the man in general propagating because he feels secure, he tends to do it because he's insecure. There is a man, and he has inside himself some seeds. There are differentiations. Why should he differentiate unless he believes he is finite? If he's infinite, he's omnipotent. If he's omnipotent, why bother to protect himself? He feels finite, so he divides himself. And he then shoots out seeds all over the place, if you don't watch him, and sets up little friends all over, which he hopes will do as they tell. They never do. But he hopes that they will, and they, born out of the same daddy, keep going like this. And so the whole confusion grows more and more and more. So this tendency to propagate the kind really comes out of a kind of fear. And fear means differentiating force. A force to differentiate. One of the very, very early Indian myths says God was once all alone, and then he feared. And this fearing caused a ripple to go through him and broke up into the universe. He was afraid of being alone. The Hebrew Bible says the same thing about Adam. It is not good for man to be alone or one, because there is no relation in absolute unity. To make a relation, we must cut the unity in half, turn the two halves back to back, and then we've got a relationship and a complete lack of unity. Which is like a man and his wife, you see. The ideal is to be like that, face to face, as the rabbis say. But when it is cut, they tend to get their round parts together like that, and their flat parts apart, and they don't understand each other anymore. And they keep banging the round parts together and getting reverberations, which they always misinterpret. And so the misunderstanding goes on, and meanwhile they shoot out more progeny in all directions to multiply the problem, which is saying P to the N to the S. So you see how intimately related all these things are, and how it doesn't matter what language you take, any word in any language will take you back to the fundamental concepts of the nation using it. And if you put the psychological type of the nation using the word as the frame of reference, and then put the word in it, you will be able to derive the meaning of the word. On the other hand, if you have a word and you know the language source of it, you know the psychology of the people who use that word. The fact that the French believe themselves to be intellectual causes them to be called French. This is derived from the Pirance, the Piratio essence again. They believe that Guerre man means war man, earthbreaker man. He calls himself Deutsch, clear. This is Deutlich, you see. I'm Deutsch. I'm very clear, I know what I'm thinking. Other people call him Bosch, because what he thinks is not so clear. So each nation has a word for every other nation, and every nation has a word for itself. And there's a frame of reference for every word, And when you put the word back in its own frame of reference, you know the psychology of the people, and when you see that the word for one nation by another nation is such, you know the attitude of the first nation for the second. Let's look at the word fool as an example. There's fool. Change that to the coil of the Hebrew, and you see we've got a simple sound shift from F to P, both labials. Shift that to double L, the polloids of Greek. We have exactly the same concept. That's English, that's Hebrew, that's Greek, and it all means the same thing, polluted. But the pylo, isn't it? The poel, the pola, the polis. The pylo means the rational process which led to the downfall, because the rational process obscures the essential purity of the soul. So there isn't a mystic in Europe or in India or China that doesn't say we must transcend the rational process, because there's an inherent dichotomy in S equals P. So the rational process cannot help us towards unity. It can merely show what rubbish there is in the rational process. So if somebody gives you a rational process that doesn't say S equals P equals S, you can apply the rational process to him and prove him to be talking nonsense, because all he's saying is S equals S, and the P is merely predication. The purpose of reasoning is to eliminate errors, and at its highest point, the intellect, yeah, it is to give directives, nothing else. Directives to the volition of the hearer. We don't discuss in order to discuss. Discuss means to strike, the discuss. To strike two together, and then they break. That's analysis. We don't discuss in order to break things in bits. We make statements in order to bias the will towards unity. The will is already in the external world biased towards disintegration, because millions of forces are acting upon it, from advertising, from radio, from sensual stimuli. The whole structure of the external world is battling against us to reduce our unity. Therefore, the legitimate use of language in its highest aspect is simply to give a directive to the will in the direction of unity. And therefore, whenever a word comes to you, you should say to yourself, does this help my unity? And if it doesn't, I don't want it. Does it fit in? It doesn't matter what it is, can you fit it in? If you can't fit it in at all, push it out. Don't say it's a bad word, say it won't fit for the time being. Sometime later on it may fit. If you get an idea and you accept it and it won't fit and you won't make it fit, you have done a very peculiar thing to yourself, which will do you ultimately not much good. Supposing there is a mind, and inside the mind you have a system of ideas integrated. That represents the intellect. I'll draw a very little hole in the middle for the soul of that person, because it's nearly obscured by the intellectual process. Then I'm going to cause the soul to push out and throw an accent here. And the stimulus comes from outside and throws into this a triangle. So that triangular reverberation goes all through the mind, by the way. And it keeps building up. All it's doing is building triangles all over. It triangulates the mind. It actually fascinates the consciousness at the mind level into triangularity. Some catatonics are like this. They fix on an idea and they cannot let go of it. It's just one idea. Now, if we are to release ourselves from that idea, we must find another idea. Supposing we found another triangle and put it next to it, like that, and then another one, and then another, and another, and then another, and find that six equilateral triangles make a circle. we've escaped from the mere triangularity. You see that when we begin to add these fundamental geometrical concepts together, we are escaping the limitations of identification with the parts. The purpose of integration is escape from finite determination. So if we add all the forms up, instead of a little thing, a wiggle like that, with no friends, which is a ground of schizophrenia, of independent activity of some brain cells, instead of that happening, if we can begin to analyze this into various forms, we can actually do this with a pair of compasses and discover that they're all stuck inside a large circle. I'm doing this with a pair of compasses on one occasion. I might even do it now anyway. And when we do so, we begin to recognize the fundamental of all form, maybe circumscription. It no longer frightens us then. We have a master concept. All forms are circumscriptions. The type of circumscription is the circle. Therefore, the circle is our dominant yantra. It is our supreme symbol for comprehending. But every circle that we know of existence, every existential circle, has parts, so we part it. It's parted by force, so we put the vertical in. But the force parts it also in its matter, so we put the horizontal. Now there is our master concept, the cross and the circle. When we see it, and think about the relations in it, realize what a right angle is there. It is an angle that is falling neither to the right nor the left. It is a right angle. It does not fall. It does not incline. It is upright here. And it is earth line horizontal here. There's no fall whatever in the right angle. Therefore, the man who identifies with the right angle has the right angle in himself, and he will not fall. If you can remember this, it's the right angle. I will. There's a Masonic device, and turn it down there. There's another right angle. And we put the compass on top of it to remind us that it is a circle. They've taken out the instruments of drawing this, the compass and the square. You see? And made it into a symbol of that. All they've done is change the symbol so they can make a little closed group and see their symbols and interpret the universal symbol behind it. Most of them do not know that that represents merely that, because the symbol is fascinating. Now the object of the symbol is to throw you backwards towards a high unity every time. And ultimately when you've got your pure unity, you put the horns on top and say the only reason this unity exists is because the absolute rotated zone of force. So that, as to my essence, although I am in being as a soul, as to my essence, I am eternal and infinite. When we put a diagram and call it a yantra, we are affirming a motion of the law. And if we allow the diagram to speak to us and act upon our minds, this is a process similar to Zen. And go round and out. Does it enclose space? What is the nature of the enclosed space as opposed to the space outside here? What is the meaning of the line that leads in and the line that leads out? This is called discursive reasoning or meditation. When you have exhausted the discursive process, you hold simultaneously the fruits of the discursive process, look at the yantra and let it act on you. At a certain point it clicks, the whole process of discursive reasoning synthesizes. This is the moment when the whole significance of the diagram suddenly springs into you and you feel a force coming in your head, putting down the body from that. Suddenly you feel like that yourself. And from that moment, whatever comes to you, you will know it's a stimulus coming in, going round, and if you don't stop it, going out in the form of a reaction. If it goes out without consideration, you've lost the energy. If you can cause the thing to go in and stay in a bit, it will work for you. Now, if you can cause it never to come out into the external world, well, I can draw a perspective diagram on this one. Suppose in there's the perspective diagram. I'll draw around it a perspective plane so that you can see it. Imagine this is a plane, board. This is the diagram drawn on it. The usual way is for the stimulus to come in and the reaction to go out like a knee jerk. If we can cause the energy to go inside, force it more and more to the center, by saying what this gross stimulus means in terms of subtle form, idea in relation to the soul is freedom. It goes straight out of the plane of manifestation, and substantially or superstantially. It gets out of the plane of manifestation, but only providing you drive it in and allow it no material expression. And yet you must not repress it in the psychological sense. It must not become unconscious. You must drive it in and in and in and in, keeping hold of it, until suddenly it flicks out at right angles to the plane of manifestation. And you then realize spirit. That's R-L in realize. Remember, R is differentiation. L is link factor. The different, the similar. To realize is actually to see the differences in the similar and the similarity in the difference. When you realize in that way, you will see that everybody, no matter who they are or what they are, from a crab to a narcissus or something like that, they're all identical. There's no difference at all, in any way whatever. And yet, all identities are absolutely dissimilar. Every R is L and every L is R. Every difference is identical and every identity is different. And the difference is a difference of stress. And the identity is essence. So the L represents the essential identity and the R represents the manifest differences. So the L is the Hebrew L. There's the L or name of God. Aleph Am Shinu, link factor. Now, the Ruach, that's letter R and the close H, which means stuck, like Scottish Ruach. The Ruach itself is this R. The link factor and the differentiation factor. But the differentiation is simply a mode of activity of the absolute identity. There is no difference whatever, absolutely, essentially. There is every difference, actually. So we have to look at the thing in two ways simultaneously. There's absolutely no essential difference. And in manifestation, there is every difference. So we are all manifestly, absolutely unique, and essentially there's no difference. So to talk about the Gan and the Fin, the aim of man to become brilliant and perfect, and the fool goose, is really to talk about the same thing. The goose is the fool, and the fool is the wise man. The FL in fool, phallus, and the pilus, palace, the prince of reason, is the same. Unless you're a fool, you will not become reasonable. The careful man who makes no mistakes makes no improvement. So if you take a mistake, you can't make a deliberate mistake. It's impossible. To be deliberate is not to make a mistake. When you make a mistake, if you examine it, it will turn you into a wise man. You can always be glad when you made a mistake, because it showed you the limits of your then knowledge. But you can't make a deliberate one.
idea of extending the field of consciousness, do you intend this to be taken literally as an experiment which one can make?
Yes.
This will be a naive question to the group, no doubt, but I'm not so well acquainted with your terminology. But where does this famous astral body fit into this business?
I mean, that's a very much abused term.
Yes.
Obviously, the word itself is the same as saint in it.
Yes.
And very, very often the theosophists use it as if it were a body of desires.
Yes.
Body of desires. But then they differentiate between lower astral and higher astral. And the sidereal body is the body of form. In its lowest aspect, the forms are stimuli causing desires. Supposing we say that the stars are, as we know them to be, sending their light to us. The spectrum analysis shows that all the stars are chemically different. So that chemistry evolves in Earth life and becomes formal determinants of body tendencies. Every chemical injected into a body produces a formal change in the mind or subtle body, because the subtle body is itself matter, although found. Now, let us take light, photons, as fine matter. So that starlight is form coming to us. That's the sunlight, because the sun is a star. You know that millions of tons of chemicals are arriving on Earth in the form of light waves. So those light waves are involved into the Earth and into plants. Plants do it by photosynthesis. The chemistry of the plant is then changed. The animal and the man eat these things and become determined by it. So that the total formal content of the stars added together and considered as a body is the sidereal body, which they then call astral body, misunderstand and then divide into higher and lower, and talk about the lower animal desires of the astral body, and confuse the terminology. Every chemical has two aspects, a formal aspect and a stimulus value. The stimulus value would be called the lower astral or desire body. And that's only an aspect of the reality, which has its other aspect, the formal one, which produces an idea. Say, medieval terminology, you could find a star is a thought. It isn't a poetical metaphor. It's a statement about the chemistry of light, involving itself in bodies on Earth and conditioning thought processes. Because every chemical is a stimulant formally. We can analyse them today with an electron microscope. We can show that the forms of all the different elements are peculiar to each element. And that the absorption of elements is the absorption of form. That the taking in of that form is taking in also not only of form, but of stimuli on the desire nature. So if we talk about the idea aspect, the sidereal body, and the lower aspect, the desire, reaction to the stimulus, that would be called the lower astral. The important thing about it is to realise why, in very early times, they were terribly careful about diet. They would eat only those things that had the form, the signature, of where they wanted to get. You know, in primitive times, if a man wanted the courage of a lion, he killed a lion and ate it. If he wanted the intelligence of a native chief down the road, he went and cut his head out, took his brains out and sealed him an atom. Now, it wasn't so very foolish. Modern dietetic principle still says, if you want to think clearly, you need a vitamin. It's exactly the same statement, disguised in new terms. If you want to live vitally, you need a vitamin. If you want to catch a new spouse, you need a vitamin. Whatever you need something that's vital, something that's alive, and is formally the correct stimulus for your purpose. So if you want to become very calm, you deliberately avoid irritant foods. If you don't want to be polyerotic, you keep off the Spanish fries. If you do want to do that, well then you take it. It depends on your purpose and where you want to get. But if you're aiming at a balanced mind, you deliberately take balancing foods. Ultimately, when you've got your balance perfect, you could assimilate the whole universe. It wouldn't matter what you took. But until you've got it, you should take balancing things. And all these are coming primarily in the form of light, involving themselves in the earth, in plants, in animals and men. And the body inside man that derives from the cellular sources is the one referred to as the astral body. But it's two aspects, form, idea, and desire, motivation. Theosophical jargon is in a hopeless mess about the astral body. I think there are dozens and dozens of books written by ladies at the loose end on the astral body, and they attribute wonderful things to it. Simply because they're careless about terms. And yet it's absolutely necessary to be clear about terms, because if you have an experience and cannot formulate it to yourself, you don't know your next directive.
Is what you've said relating in any way to the continual dilution of substances that are not there?
Yes, yes. What he's trying to do is give you a safe form, one that just provokes you, not too much to disturb your balance, but sufficient to put you on guard so that you can decide what you're going to reject. Infinitesimal dose theory. The Arapath says, give him a big bang, the whole body will react and try to do something about it. In a short term, the homeopath says, we don't mind taking longer, and therefore we're prepared to be more gentle. It's the same with the evolution of consciousness. If you give yourself big shocks, you become wise quicker, but you may be very broken up in the process. If you want to keep your form fairly intact, you have to go slowly. If you're not prepared to see how a man reacts to an insult, then you won't understand certain things in yourself. Can you say something rude in company without blushing? It's not a statement about the company, it's a statement about your attitude to the company and your hidden coiled up responses. You can't know unless you test yourself. And every man should devise his own test if he wants to go at his own rate.
When you refer to the Ferris wheel and the cycle of life, the coming and going, and we come back very close to this little yard and the field.
Yes.
Seemed as though we were coming to it from another direction.
There's an Indian saying, the soul is as big as your thumb. It's an astrological, the sun pertains to Venus. And Venus pertains to desire in its passive aspect. The soul is said to be passive to the infinite forces above it. It takes its infinite orders. And then it involves itself in matter and becomes passive to matter for a time. The soul is as big as your thumb. And the thumb is a pusher. It's a push. It's volition. Desire is really the aftermotion of volition. So a man's soul is exactly as big as his willpower. No bigger and no smaller. And that's the same as the Yun point. The point of initiation. So they used to go, let the man live, and let the man die. It's entirely phallic in shape.
Yeah.
It represents that same fundamental creative force. One of the worst things that they used to do in the old days for willful people was hang them up by the thumbs. Very unpleasant. Worse than hanging up by your little finger. Because there are more nerves in the thumb than in the rest of the hand put together. It feels awful. Get hold of your own thumb and you'll start screaming to be let loose.
Am I correct in assuming that the circle with the cross in the centre is the same from which has been constructed the astrological Yes, the astrological symbology.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. We haven't time now, but perhaps on another occasion we can go through the astrological symbology. In time should it be coherent. This represents the cardinal points. This is fire, water, air, earth. That's the gross material body. The water one symbolizes the fluids of the body and the feeling life. The air symbolizes the intellectual life. And the fire, the nervous life, nervous energy. The cardinal points are hinge points and symbolize undifferentiated nervous energy, undifferentiated feeling, undifferentiated intellection, undifferentiated absorption of matter. And then each one moves in a triangle. So the differentiated nervous energy moves from Ram to Neo, which is the first organization of the undifferentiated as volition, nervous will. That moves to the mutable, the Sagittarian position, where it can become either differentiated or not at will. The Leo type always wants to establish his will because he's only just started doing it. So he cannot afford yet to go back into the Aries position because he hasn't yet established himself. When he gets into this position, he doesn't care whether he's there or there. He's completely disfired of nervous energy. The Cancer type feels in a very vague, undefined way. Then it moves to Scorpio, which attaches itself with great zeal. So that the Scorpio type is tremendously zealous and he never lets go of a problem once he's decided it's his. Then it passes to Pisces, which is mutable again. And the Pisces is sometimes vague, like the Cancer type, and sometimes bounces onto a thing, like the Scorpio type. And we come to the air position. Libra is perception. Just all perceptions, whatever. Then there is the gathering of perceptions together in Aquarius as memory, the establishment of the perception in the memory. And then it goes to Gemini, which is the reason, or mutable again, which looks at the perceptions and at the memory alternately. Looks into the external world, then into the memory, to recognize it, recognize, refit it together. Then the Earth sign, undifferentiated absorption of matter, and then it goes into Taurus, the secretion of matter in the glandular system, then into Virgo, the circulation of the chemicals secreted in the body. And again, this is a mutable position. It can either secrete or absorb in the circulation process. And then, of course, I added to that the seven planetary symbols, and then the mutations of all these together, and the permutations of forces in them become very complex. But given the position of a man at birth, his major characteristics as to his physical behavior and the behavior of his mind, which is also material, although fine, can be mapped out with very, very great accuracy. The only thing you cannot predict is the soul, simply because it has no parts. It is free and is therefore not predictable. But as most people are not soul conscious, but only mind or body conscious, they are predictable. So the non-predictables are the souls. The soul compass is actually a complete Chaldean symbology. It tells exactly the same truths that you find in other systems, but in a very, very coherent way. Take Jupiter means expansion, Saturn is contraction, Mercury is rotation, the product of the two. Venus is passive desire, Mars is active desire. That's a pair. Sun is radiating energy, the Moon is absorbing and reflecting. That's another pair. We have three pairs and an odd one. The odd one is Mercury, which means rotation of the whole thing. So the whole process is in the body insofar as they're dependent on rotation, on circulation of the body, circulation of nervous energy, are mercurial processes. Hence the mercurial man is a quick man. Mercury is the Roman name for the Messiah.
the Greek Hermes, the Egyptian Tote, the Hebrew Messiah, are all different terms in different psychological references. For the one fact in the consciousness that can fly over the whole of phenomena very, very quickly and retain the synthetic significance of all. Saturn is Satan, the devil. Jupiter is Jupiter, God the Father. The universe is a product of the opposition between the two. Between the absolutely free Jupiter and the absolutely bound Saturn, the gross matter. And between the two, life appears as an interrelation function. There's more rubbish written about astrology yet, actually, than about any other single subject. It's a very, very coherent system.
So I think it's time to pull the people away from it and give them the only little chance to get something out of it.
Yeah. Time to talk to you, Mr. Beck. Statement about the fall. It says, awake, Finnegan. And it says, morning. Now, Lucifer is called the star of the morning, isn't he?
Yes.
Oh, Lucifer, thou bright star of the morning. Awake, for morning, that's Lucifer, in the bowl of night, that's negation, has flung the stone, that's the material world, and put the stars, that's the pre-fall formative principles, to flight. And the hunter of the east, that's the internal east, the mystical east, where your soul is. Below the hunter of the east, the sun, your will, your illumination, is called the sultan's turret. The sultan is the sultan, soul fire, the soul of fire. Turret, turret, law, torrent, in a noose, the light. The whole of it is subject to analysis metaphysically, you say.
Well, he seems to write both ways. One way seems to be deep drinking to be ready for tomorrow, we may die, but at other times he seems to refer to something beyond death and knowledge and so forth.
It's dialectics. Yeah, those who can't see the truth, let them eat and drink because they'll be dead tomorrow. Those who can see, who flung the stone. Who flungs down the chains of life? They can get out of it. But not everybody can get out. If everybody got out of once, the universe would disappear. Because the universe is Maya, it's a form of play, kept in being by interested souls. So if we all suddenly got out, it would disappear, and God would have to deliberately start again. That would be terrible.
May I please very briefly go back to my question concerning the astral body?
Yes.
I was not thinking so much in terms of its theosophical connection, but in relation to what you had taught tonight, I recalled Gurdjieff once having remarked that it was a very expensive luxury, and I was wondering if I could find some explanation for myself of that saying in your
exposition.
Yes.
Well, he's saying that let's take the sidereal, the astral body, as a properly formed body, a real body of star form, of cosmic form, back to cosmic form, and it's very expensive to get it. You can only get it by tremendous pains. You can only get thought by suffering. No other way. Pleasure won't give it. Therefore, it's expensive. And when you've got it, you have to throw it away. So it's a luxury. It's not an essential. Just like Plotina said, first you have to become purely reasonable, and then you must throw the ball away. Because the soul doesn't need it. But it thinks it does up to the time it's integrated it. Plotinus is very clear on that, you know. Very, very clear. Oh, one of the clearest writers in Europe. That the ball of reason has got to be seized before you can throw it away. It's elementary logic. A person who is irrational trying to throw reason away can't. He's below it. Can't throw away what he hasn't got. And as long as he's sub-rational, he's determined by forces below and above. And if he climbed up to the point of understanding that cross in the circle, accepted what it means, that's his ball. That's the bauble offered by goblins to princes to fool them in the fairy tales. The bubble universe, the expanding universe, the astronomers.